Let me go ahead and call the Mesa Housing Services Governing Board to order. Mr. Egan, welcome. Back at it again. We have a couple of items. One is to hear a presentation, discuss and take action on a resolution approving the Violence Against Women Act additions to the administrative plan. I think it's fairly self-explanatory. We do it or we lose funding, so.
That's basically it.
All right. And I think it's straightforward. I think that probably we're doing it anyway, but is there any discussion on that item?
Mayor, I do think there's just one. I think we want to just provide one clarification of why we're doing that, because I think it is significant. The issue about the leases. Trish,
yes, what this act does is it allows us to keep members of the family in the apartment if there is violence in the household. Currently, what it is if there's violence in the household, we're required to remove them from the Section 8 program, and they can be put out of their apartment. This actually protects the victims of violence and allows us to keep their Section 8 vouchers for the family, not the perpetrator, but the family members, and they cannot be evicted from their apartment. That's basically what the Violence Against Women Act does.
Right. Can the perpetrator be a woman or a man? Or
yes.
It can be. All right. Any other questions? I think there is a resolution that is from the Housing Governing Board. It's actually item number one. We have that in the packet. It says, be it resolved by the Mesa Housing Service Governing Board, Section 1. There's three sections to it. I assume that is what you need approved here today?
Yes, authorized. You do need the resolution approved.
Okay, does somebody want to make a motion to that effect?
Second.
All right, have a motion and second to, and it looks like I'm the signature on that, to authorize me to sign that resolution. Mm-hmm. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Okay, let the record reflect that we have five ayes and one nay. Six ayes in one nay. All right. With Councilmember Rawls voting nay and Councilmember Walters being absent. Number two is hear a presentation, discuss and take action on a resolution approving the 2008 payment standards schedule. And that is on the very back of the packet. There's a resolution to that effect. And then I think the Exhibit A would be attached to that resolution. Any discussion on that item? I think everything then is pegged at basically 90% of the fair market rentals.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. Any discussion? Somebody want to entertain a motion to the effect of authorizing me to sign that resolution?
So moved.
Right. Second. Motion and second. Any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Aye.
All right, let the record reflect again that Councilmember Rawls votes to oppose. And Vice Mayor Walters is absent, but it does pass with the remaining of the body approving. The next item is adjournment. So you do adjourn. All right, I have a motion and second to adjourn. Is there?
We'll go ahead and do that. And then.
All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. We are adjourned from the Mesa Housing Service Governing Board. Mr. Egan, thank you for your
thank you.
This morning.
I thought for a minute that I was invited down to celebrate my birthday, but. With a surprise party, but I see that the guys didn't get the message. But I,
yeah.
Oh, I got. Thank you very much. I appreciate.
Yeah, that coffee's controversial too. On the expense.
Mayor, also Trish, why don't you introduce the young lady next to you?
Mayor and Council, I'd like to introduce Carolyn Olson. She's the new Housing and Revitalization Director. She started on Tuesday, so this is her third day with the city.
Well, if we knew that, and I think we did know that you just started this week, we could have had a bunch of questions.
Next time, there'll
all
be
right,
more.
Let's you off easy on this first one. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, let me call the Mesa City Council study session of Thursday, September 6, 2007 to order. We have six items. The first is here a presentation is discuss the proposed name change for Williams Gateway Airport. Good morning, Scott. Mr.
Good morning, Cousy. Mayor, Council. Lynn Cousy's here this morning to talk about, obviously, an issue many of you have heard about sensibly the name change at Williams Gateway, and also fill you in on some of the projects going on at the airport. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Lynn for his presentation.
Thank you, Scott. Good morning, Mayor. Good morning, members of council, ladies and gentlemen. For the last 13 or 14 years, we've been working diligently with a lot of support from a lot of people to transform what was an abandoned Air Force base into a vibrant employment hub for the community and commercial airport. We've had some successes over the years. This is a picture of the Cessna Aircraft Service Center for Citation Business Jets. This is a 90,000 square foot building that is under construction. We have a variety of other corporate locates on the airport. Folks whose name you will recognize, folks like Boeing, L3 Communications. This is the Embraer Aircraft Service Center, which is also under construction on the airport. It's a 40,000 square foot building for servicing the Embraer very light jet, and one of many projects that are under construction right now. This is a picture of the passenger terminal. It was an existing building that we've modified for use as a passenger terminal, and we've made some recent improvements to that building as well to help with the flow of traffic through the building, making more restroom space available to the secure room, and relocating the TSA security screening room into a larger space. This is the Arizona State University hangar and classroom, which is we've just finished construction of. There will be a ribbon-cutting celebration on October 3rd. And if you haven't already, you should all receive invitations to that ribbon cutting on October 3rd at the invitation of ASU. This is a building that the Airport Authority actually has constructed and will own and lease back to the university. This is a building being constructed by Fleming West, a building that was on hold for a long period of time, is now again under construction. Actually, the roof structure is up at this point in time, and the building has been leased to one of our existing tenants, Silver State Helicopters. So we're excited about having that come online as well. We have had some success with passenger service. This is a picture of the Vision Airlines aircraft that's flying twice a week to Las Vegas. We are expecting that they're going to add additional service to Las Vegas, and they're working very hard to bring a service to Long Beach as well. We're looking forward to that beginning sometime this winter. Also, we've had Allegiant Air service to Laughlin and Reno on about a monthly basis since 2003. But in July of this year, Allegiant announced that they would like to establish a new base of operations at Gateway and offer nonstop service to the Phoenix Mesa metropolitan area from 13 destinations throughout the Midwest, the Northwest, and California. That service will begin October 25th. Several destinations have been announced already, including two in California, two in the Dakotas, two in Illinois, Rockford, Chicago, and Peoria, as well as Bellingham, Washington, which we already have some experience with. So we're excited about that. In looking at the year that just ended, the fiscal year that ended at the end of June, these are some of the statistics. Airport operating revenues were just over $7 million. Aircraft operations topped 300,000, which put us in the top 40 busiest airports in the nation. Fuel sales were about 5.5 million gallons, and we did service 18,800 passengers with the limited service that we had, including some service that started to Bellingham and Chicago Gary that didn't last very long because of the financial weakness of the carriers that we were hosting. We did handle about 160,000 pounds of cargo, and we completed about $7.5 million in capital expenditures on the airport, not including private investment. We are in the midst of an airport master plan update. The master plan was originally done in 1994 and was updated in 99, and we're updating it again this year. We've had the first public information workshop, and we'll have another one. Actually, this says September 19th. That's been moved to September 18th. That will be in the evening at our offices. And all of the draft documents for the master plan update and all of the final documents as they're finalized are available on the web. You can access those through our website, which of course is flywga.org. We expect to have the final document ready for the board's consideration in July, but I know that the major elements of that plan will be discussed at the by staff at least in November, so we're accelerating that to try and match that to the progress of the city's southeast area general plan update and economic study. Talk a little bit about the name change. When we first started getting interest from the airlines, serious interest a couple of years ago, we heard from the airlines that they were concerned that the airport wasn't identifiable with respect to the geography that we were trying to serve. It didn't say Phoenix in the name, and that was important to the airlines. So let's talk about that a little bit. This, of course, is a history of the name that the facility has had over time. It started out as the Higley Air Base, then became the Higley Army Airfield, then Williams Army Airfield and Williams Air Force Base, and then, of course, in 93, Williams Gateway Airport. So it has had a variety of names over the last 60 years. A little bit about Lieutenant Charles Williams. There has been a lot of misinformation about him, so we've put together a little bit of a quick bio sketch. He was born in 1898 at Fort Huachuca in Arizona, but he lived most of his life in the East, graduated from the University of Tennessee. He was an infantry combat man during World War I and was recognized for outstanding service. He became an aerial photographer in 1923, commissioned a first lieutenant in 1924, and he died in 1927 in Hawaii during an aerial maneuver. The reason I put that up there is because there's a lot of misinformation that he, in fact, trained at Williams. He did not, and that he was a pilot during World War II, and he was not, and that he was shot down in combat, and he was not. So I just want everybody to know what the facts are. Obviously had an outstanding career in the military, but was not a pilot until after World War I. In looking at the name change, we did hear from the airlines, but we wanted some more definitive information, so we actually engaged West Group Research to talk to the airlines. We gave them the names of 9 airlines that we thought might be interested in the airport as a commercial service airport, and we asked them to interview those 9 airlines. 5 of the 9 did agree to the interview, although I do not know which 5 responded to the interview. But these are some of the responses. While the local community may be aware of Williams Gateway, customers who fly to Arizona have never heard of the facility. If Williams Gateway is trying to sell itself as a viable alternative airport for the Phoenix area, it needs to identify itself with that geographic area. And currently, there is no identification between Williams Gateway and the Phoenix metropolitan area, a very dynamic market. And Williams should use a name that, 1, contains the word Phoenix, and 2, sounds like it's a major airport. Those were some of the comments that we got through West Group Research from the airline executives. We also talked to some of the airport managers from airports who had recently changed their name to include the major city that they're close to. And there have been a lot of those lately. 2 airports in the Boston area, Worcester and Manchester, New Hampshire. 2 airports in the Los Angeles area, including Ontario, which is now LA, Ontario. These are some of the things we got from the airport managers. The main reason we changed the name was to associate ourselves with Boston. Only 10% of people have ever heard of Worcester. The intent was to make this airport more marketable outside the area. And keep in mind that 80% of all airline tickets are being bought online, so it is critical that your name comes up when people Google a particular city. That 80% of airline tickets being bought online was not a factor when we named the airport in 1993, 1994, but it certainly is critical today. So given that information from West Group Research, working with my marketing staff and with our marketing consultant, Barclay Communications, I will be recommending to the Airport Authority at their next board meeting that the airport name become Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. We did talk about a number of varieties of this name, Mesa Phoenix Gateway, Phoenix Mesa Williams Gateway, and others, but this is the one that that seemed to come to the top of the list, and this is the one that I will be recommending to the Board of Directors on the 15th of September for their consideration. Not wanting to turn our backs on the history of the facility or the history of the man, Charles Williams, let me come back to that in a second. What the name change does for us, the airport serves the entire Phoenix metropolitan area, identifies it as being located in Mesa, uses the word gateway, the gateway to Arizona, the American Southwest, vacation destinations, including Scottsdale, Sedona, and Tucson, Those things are very important to the airlines. And it does give us the ability to continue using Gateway Aviation Services, the Gateway Tower, which is the tower call sign, has been since 93, and other names such as the Gilbert Gateway Town Center and other businesses and developments that include the word gateway in the area. Implementation of the name change, we expect we will develop a logo and a style manual, marketing program. We will have to change signs and, of course, change our printed materials. We will have to change our identification in federal publications and in the commercial aviation search engines, which is, of course, the major reason for considering doing this. We do expect that this will cost us, we've gotten some preliminary estimates, cost us between $40,000 and $80,000 to change the signs and do the other things that we need to do to affect the name change. What we expect is international recognition as a Phoenix destination, increased commercial ticket sales with Phoenix Mesa as the destination. And of course, that's the main reason for considering doing this. But again, as I said, wanting to honor the history of the facility and the history of the man, Lieutenant Williams, we did establish an email site called Preserve Williams Heritage at flywga.org. And we are encouraging people to let us know what they think about the proposed name change and what they think we should do to preserve and honor the man and the facility. And these are some suggestions for things that we could do to honor that. We could name the passenger terminal after Lieutenant Williams. We could adopt at Williams Field as a part of the name or as a subtext under the name. We could bring back the Willie Days Air Show. That was a popular event. It was expensive. It would be difficult and expensive to do, but it should be considered, I believe. There are several streets that we could name after Lieutenant Williams. And the road that serves the East Terminal should be Williams Field Road on that alignment on the east side. And then we have a T-38 aircraft on a pedestal, and we could expand that site and call it the Lieutenant Williams Memorial Park or some name like that, and expand that park to include portions of the university and the community college campus as well, something that's been talked about for some time. That is the presentation. That is the name that we're recommending to the board. If the board agrees to change the name, then we will move forward with the implementation program and with the preserving the heritage of the site and the man. And I'd be most happy to answer any questions or let Scott answer them.
Thanks. Mayor, I just wanted to point out that this is on just for information and discussion. Obviously, the Williams Gateway Authority Board will be making that decision, but of course Mayor Hawker's our representative to that, and I'm sure he would appreciate any feedback that any of the council members may have about this change.
Comments? Scott?
Thank you for the presentation, Lynn. That's the second time I've heard it in 2 days. And it's great every time.
Good.
I hear it.
Thank you.
But let me ask you this. O'Hare, Logan, John Wayne, Ronald Reagan, all those are airports located across the United States. They don't have the name of the city that they're located in. How do you respond to folks who would say, well, these airports don't have Chicago O'Hare, is sometimes how we hear, but you don't hear Chicago O'Hare, Boston Logan, John Wayne, Ronald Reagan in Washington, D.C.? How do you respond to folks like
As a matter of fact, you did establish that, I think, in your comments there, that those airports actually do have the city name. It is Chicago O'Hare and it is Boston Logan, but that's not really the point. The point is that we're starting from scratch. People in Illinois and South Dakota and California don't know where we are. They know from 50 or 60 or 70 years of history where Chicago O'Hare is, but they don't know where Williams Gateway is. We need to identify ourselves with the city of Phoenix in order to be able to have people who Google us from Illinois or South Dakota or Indiana find us when they're looking for a Phoenix destination, because we are a Phoenix destination.
Thank you.
Rex?
Yeah, I think what's changing the whole world is Google. I mean, 20 years ago, you know, you name something after a local personality. Now when you go on Google and you're in Florida, if you hit Williams, you may get Williams City up in northern Arizona first. I mean, you wouldn't even know of it. So whether I agree with it or think it's great or not, I think for a business aspect, it needs to be done. Now, how you memorialize, a lot of pilots trained there. It was one of the busiest fighter training bases in the world for a long time. I think naming the terminal, naming a street, putting a plaque on the terminal that explains the history and the training in World War II and all the way through the Vietnam era, where pilots would be a very good way to do it. What people could read was they entered the terminal and left it and know a little of the history of it. Park, I think those are all good things. They're not a huge amount of money, but just the amount of money to change over the signage, I think you're going to make it up in passenger tickets in a period of very short time as a marketing expense. As I said, 80% of, I didn't realize 80% of tickets are now sold online. That's a pretty powerful. But going back to names, you know, Mesa's the 38th largest city in the United States. We're 39,000 people behind Atlanta. And people have told me it's the largest city no one's ever heard of outside of Arizona. And Fort Worth had that same problem until they put Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. When you're linked with something else, all of a sudden people start knowing where you are, what you are, your major city. It's hard to be in the shadow of a larger city, but let's recognize where we are, and we're always going to be there. And so rather than fighting it, you embrace it, and you move forward, and you do something good with it. So Phoenix Mesa Airport, or Gateway Airport, I think makes some sense to me.
Thank you.
No comments, Tom?
I think it's a fine name change. I have one, I guess two comments on the timing. One, Google's been around for a long time. Online sales have been around time. I question if this has been a problem, why it hasn't been addressed earlier, which leads to my second point, which is I don't like the appearance that Phoenix has bought the name of the airport because they're now a member. And I'd like the board and the councils that are involved to make it clear that that's not the case. But the timing stinks. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments? I'm going to be at the board meeting supporting it. I brought it on the agenda and wanted this type of discussion because it didn't, anything that we could do to accelerate the development of that area of town. And I think that just the Phoenix Mesa metropolitan business complex that's going to be developed around there, it has another reason for being that Phoenix Mesa metropolitan area, because I think when we start doing international flights and the rest, it will give that kind of that center of jobs and activity with Intel and everything else that's geographically located from there, and all the development that we're going to have at Williams Gateway, 100,000 jobs, and Pinal County growing. I think we really are playing in the big leagues, and it's not Williams Air Force Base. That was a terrific military training base, and it survived and did its mission extremely well, and our mission is to have that as a job center and that airfield and the university and the infrastructure all come together, and I think this name will help to promote that. It did not. I would have suggested the Phoenix Mesa name whether Phoenix ever joined the Gateway Authority. It was being proposed prior to them even joining. And so I'd like to just see that take place because I think it will help to jumpstart that. With Phoenix on board, I appreciate their sharing their expertise and how do you get other airlines to locate and how do you market to them and what are the positives. So they've been a great player, but they're not the majority player there. We still have control of that with our partners. But I think the Phoenix Mesa name at this time is appropriate to make the change, and I think it'll really help that Air Force Port prosper. It certainly won't hinder. Any other comments? Scott?
Just to go off what Tom said, I agree that timing stinks, but whether it happens now or in a year or 2 years or 3 years with Phoenix on the board, that was going to be a question raised. I was sitting in for the mayor at one of the meetings of the Williams Gateway Airport Board, and this issue was brought up, and it should be noted, and I think it's worth everybody knowing that Phoenix understands the image problem in this, and they were trying to, the mayor had indicated he wanted to abstain from that vote because of the image, although I don't think the rules are going to allow him to do that, but he had indicated that at one point.
Okay. And that's the kind of comments that I wanted to make, because we live in a political world perception is reality in politics, and I just need it needs to be out there that this is a good change. It would have happened anyway. It probably should have happened earlier, and there's no connection between the fact that they're now a member of the authority and the name change. It's a commercial business development tool, and I appreciate Mayor Gordon's position, and I appreciate what the mayor has said. That's what I was trying to get out on the record down here.
Okay. Any other discussion on this item? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Item number three is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on planned community districts. Oh, yep, you're right. I did. Let me go back to two. I was trying to get through this. All in favor of three? No. Okay. Thank you. Number two is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on lighting standards for Mountain Ridge.
Good morning, Mayor and Council members. I'm Alan Sanderson, the City Traffic Engineer, and here this morning to present and seek direction on a request by the developer of Mountain Bridge Community to modify the street lighting requirements for his development. The area that Mountain Bridge covers is outlined here in red. It's basically south of Hermosa Vista, west of Ellsworth, 92nd Street alignment, north of McClellan, goes a little bit west of Hawes, and then back up Hawes to McClellan. A development agreement for this development is coming to council, I believe, on September 17th. The developer has expressed a desire to really know if he can have a reduced level of lighting at the same time the development agreement is considered, because he considers it key to his development. Just briefly, the requirements the city has right now, we have two areas with two different sets of standards. Everything outside the desert uplands, all streets have to be lit. It's based on a nationally recognized standard, and the lighting levels depend on the street classification and the land use. In general, benefits of street lighting are basically lower crash rates at nighttime. And typically, or particularly nationwide, you see fewer crashes where vehicles hit things, pedestrians, fixed objects, other vehicles, animals, and fewer runoff road crashes. It's widely perceived to be a deterrent to crime, provides better visibility for bicyclists and pedestrians. And experience across the country has been that just lighting intersections also serves to reduce nighttime crashes, reducing intersection nighttime crashes, obviously. Desert Uplands has a different standard for street lighting. In fact, Desert Uplands has two different standards for street lighting. One is a reduced lighting over the rest of the city, and the second is an area where no public street lighting is required. In 2004, Council approved the reduced Desert Uplands lighting standard, which basically takes the local street standard that applies elsewhere in the city and applies it to collector streets in Desert Uplands, and then has a further reduced light level on local streets within Desert Uplands of lighting intersections and basically streetlights no more than 400 feet apart. In 2006, Council approved an area within Desert Uplands where no public street lighting is required. And this map shows the Desert Uplands area. It's outlined in black here. In Northeast Mesa goes down to University, follows the CAP canal up to Power Road, and then up to the city boundary, the Tano National Forest boundary. This area in blue, which is east of Hawes, north of McDowell, is the area where no public street lighting is required as of the council's action last year. The area in red is the Mountain Bridge development area, and all these gray shaded areas are unincorporated areas which typically don't have any street lights because the county requires no street lights anywhere for development within the county. What the Mountain Bridge developer is asking for is a permission to use a light level that's less than the Desert Upland standard for the reduced lighting level, but above the dark no lighting area. He's asking that lights only be installed on collector roads at intersections, subdivision entrances, and other key locations. and his reasons for requesting this are to protect the dark skies in that desert uplands area and to protect the views of the city lights that you get from that desert uplands foothill area. And again, he considers it really integral to his whole development concept. This is a plan for Mountain Bridge, and the streets that are colored here indicate the public collector streets. Everything coming off of this is proposed to be private driveways, private streets. So it's these colored streets, streets that are highlighted in color here, that the request applies to. The request does not apply to McKellops, Ellsworth, Hawes, or McClellan. Those would be lit to the current city standard. Now, his cross-section, or his design for these collector streets, I think is key to considering this request. And what they're proposing are basically two separate roadways separating for the different directions of traffic. He's got a raised median that's going to range from 30 to 60, and in some places wider than that. So you'll have a big area in here between the two halves of the roadway, if you will. They're also proposing the sidewalks be set well back away from the roadway area on the order of 25, 26 feet. They're also proposing lighting along the sidewalk area. So they're trying to create still keep it look like a desert environment, open, more rural looking than what you'd have in the typical urban or suburban subdivision. In addition, the collector streets are being planned for 30-mile-an-hour speed limits. And the median openings would only occur at locations where there are public street intersections or where there are driveway entrances. So the potential conflict points along the collector streets would be limited. And the width of the streets would allow room for a comfortable bike lane, probably a 7 or 6 foot wide bike lane. So all those factors, I think, tend to reduce the potential for crashes along the collector streets. Based on their request, it's estimated the spacing of streetlights along the collectors in Mountain Bridge would range from about 230 feet to 1,200 feet with an average of about 600 feet. Now, if the desert upland standard, well, that's their request. And just, I guess, as a point of reference, if you were to take the local street standard we have now for desert uplands and apply that, then the maximum spacing between lights would be 400 feet. So it would be darker than what is applied to local streets in the rest of desert uplands. This figure estimates where the street lights would be based on their development plans, and each little diamond represents a street light location. So given, if we've thought about this quite a bit, and given the unique characteristics of the area and the proposed design of the collector streets, staff would be comfortable with the reduced lighting level that's being requested by the developer. There's an alternative. You could apply the desert upland standard as it is. You could apply the desert upland standard for local streets. It's really up to council, and we wanted to bring it to council because these streetlight standards are actually specified in the city code. It's not something that the staff really felt we had the authority to adjust.
So. Do the streetlights changing, if we approve this, does that then lock in the pattern for the roadways too? I would hate to say you can do it and then the roadway pattern comes back in some other without the median, because that's somewhat locks mine. I mean, if the bike pass and you got lit areas for walking along the side and the rest, then that was part of the reason I wanted the streetlights so you could see people. But this way, it sounds like if that road pattern moves forward, I'm comfortable with the light pattern. Just want to make sure they could be linked.
Mayor Hawker, Council, I think we could write the ordinance in such a way as to link that, and I agree that is the critical difference in my mind as well. It's tied to the street design and street layout.
Okay. All right. Otherwise, I think it's a great area to do it, and I think it'll probably work out there. Councilmember Griswold.
How wide are these streets?
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Griswold, the Griswold, the roadways themselves would be 20 feet wide for each direction, but they would be separated by a 30 to 60 foot, in some cases wider, median.
With large desert trees, you've got roads, and then you have meandering paths on the side. And DC Ranch and some of the high-end developments, as I've noticed what they've done, is they've lit the pedestrian ways because people don't carry headlights, and they figured out cars do carry headlights. So they don't light the streets as much, but they do light the pedestrian way, which seems to be a more modern and aesthetically pleasing one. I think you get a choice of the kind of environment you want to live in. If you don't like this environment, don't buy there. But it seems to be very popular. Where we've done it above, they're building $3 million homes, etc. Falcon Field is now filling up with new businesses. A lot of people that live up there are moving their business there. This is 700 acres, and 300 acres is going to be virgin desert, open desert. So I think it's a good area to do it for, and I would look forward to seeing what kind of housing we can develop in that area. It would be good for our area.
Okay. This one's discuss and provide direction, so I guess we could do a motion at some point, too. Scott?
I like the idea of this is the city being flexible on these issues, because we have different parts. We have an urban area, potentially two, once William Gateway opens up. We have suburban, and in this case, we have rural desert. So the opportunity to provide a little flexibility in the code is a really good idea. I want to temper that a little bit with, I think we need to buffer it. There is a national standard for lighting. There's some safety issues involved. And once we approve this, we'll end up happening. There will not be any lights. If, but at some point down the road, residents in this area decide that the streets need to be lit, and it's going to be on the city to install those lights at the cost of all the current residents. So I guess I'm going to ask a question here. Is it possible that we could collect an in-lieu payment of some type for street lighting in the event? And if we can collect an in-lieu payment, what happens after? I mean, how long could we hold that and before we return it to the developer?
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, right now, I don't believe we have a mechanism in our code for an in-lieu payment for streetlights.
Can we do a development agreement?
We are coming forward with a development agreement with this developer. I'm trying to think off the top of my head how that would be incorporated into the development agreement. We can certainly look at that. I think the development agreement is fairly far along in its development, but we can go back and look at that and see if there is a mechanism available.
Could Mayor and Councilmember Summers, I would just suggest that in this case, because of the uniqueness of the design, staff really believes that it is sufficient street lighting, and probably to ask for in lieu just on the possibility that later on there would be a demand for it would probably we probably wouldn't get the appropriate dollars to begin with, because it would have to be redesigned and new conduit installed.
We take in lieu for roads on the possibility that they might expand.
We take in lieu for roads when they're not developed, and we know that it's a when it's developed, not an if. And we put them in accounts, and we keep them there. And I don't think we do in lieu with the idea that maybe the road will be built. We really believe they will be built. And in this case, I think it might be a little clearer to the developer, a better development agreement, not being a lawyer, to just allow the standard to be built as the council decides, and not try to develop an in-lieu for some future possibilities. Okay, we could always do an SID later if the community really wanted to do increased
rankings. But if you're still here in 10 years and this comes back, I do reserve the right to say I told you so.
Absolutely.
All right.
Mayor Harker, I may be able to clarify the in-lieu business a little bit. Mm-hmm. Ours, when a development comes in, they're required to build all the streets to the standards that apply to them. And sometimes, for whatever reason, it's a piece of street that doesn't connect with anything else, or we have another project coming along that we can conclude it with. We may choose to require an in-lieu payment to cover building the street to that requirement, to that standard, instead of having the developer do it. But the in-lieu mechanism really doesn't apply to what if we want to do something to a different standard later. I think that would be problematic in my non-lawyer viewpoint. I don't know about the law aspects of it.
Well, if the developer thought that there was a issue with him marketing the property because the residents that were looking at that area wanted more light on the major ones, I guess he could go ahead and oversize his conduit, or maybe it's would accommodate the extra street lights anyway. And then he's set. If it doesn't sell with that type of lighting system and the rest, then he can put in more lights, or if there was some other issue. But I'm not sure that the city should get involved in it. I think this works, especially in the Desert Uplands area. Rex has been a real proponent of letting those residents out there have the lifestyle that they like, and one of them is limiting the amount of streetlights so they can enjoy the nightlights. So I think this is a big enough area, and with the design of the roadways, I think we ought to just go and give them a chance to show that this is another product that will be marketable. So, Tom?
I agree. I have one question, or actually two questions. Andalusian Drive looks like it goes under the new McKellips. Is that going to be an underpass, or is it going to be an actual intersection?
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Walls, that's actually where their signature bridge is going to go across McKellip, so that drive will
take the
street of the Collector Street above McKellip's on the mountain bridge.
Okay, it appears to me that south of that proposed McKellip's, there's a bend in the road, and it's a long way till you hit the red street, which is Mountain Bridge Drive. They might just want to consider putting a light where that road bends. Because if they come across the bridge and then down and then the road turns and there's no light there, I mean, I don't like to nitpick things, but that kind of jumped off the pages to me as kind of a fairly, maybe one more right there where the word parcel 12 ends. Not that I want to place it to any degree of certainty or anything, but it looks like a dangerous turn without any lighting, either coming under an underpass or over a bridge. So just a suggestion that you might want to make to them.
Yeah, I think we can look at that as we see the actual plans for these streets come in. This is
right, and I know these are just proposed locations, but exactly. I just think that's kind of it looks like a dead spot combined with a potentially dangerous T-intersection, curve, bridge, all sort of squeezed together there in one area, and mm-hmm. Streetlight might not hurt at that point.
Dead spot.
Yeah,
okay. Dead spot.
That's good.
One of the unique features of this project, and same people that did Las Sendas has a north and south, and the kids can't play with each other because McDowell goes down the middle of it. You can't get to school over the top of it, etc. So they've built a bridge over. People can ride bikes and be connected. The two communities are now one, go back and forth. They're building a school on the south side. It would be a very interesting development to get done, but the bridge basically frames the Superstitions Mountains. As you drive down McKellips, you're going to look right at the Superstitions through these arched bridges there. So it should be aesthetically pleasing development.
Okay, I think our agreement to move forward with the changing the standard in this area to allow them to do something close to what here is proposed. So what is the next step? Do we need a motion? Yes. Come before council? Is this all we need?
Yep. Mayor, I believe Alan has gotten the direction. They're going to come forward with a proposed ordinance that will be introduced and then considered by the council.
Okay. So we'll look forward to the ordinance. And
thank you very much.
All right. Okay. Item number 3 is hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on planned community districts.
Thank you. Mayor, Council, good morning. We're here to
bring you up to date on where we are in our discussion of the plan development, plan community districts that we've been working on now for a couple of months. We're going to provide a little bit of background on the reasons we think this ordinance would be helpful in our overall code of ordinances, provide some background material on how this tool can work, talk about where we are in the overall process and what we're looking for today, and then describe some elements of the draft ordinance as we have it today, and then seek further direction from you as we go as to how this can continue to evolve as we go on with the process. First of all, in terms of the overview and the purpose, this new code would provide for more predictability in the process. As you'll see as we talk about the code and the types of materials that we would get up front when we do the initial zoning and get the community plan, we'll get up front a lot of information about how the project will be developed on a high level sense, so that we can then look at the later stages and context of that overall project. And the plan that gets approved up front will then provide both the developer and neighboring property owners some understanding about how the property will be developed and give more predictability in that sense. But also in terms of the sequencing of the development, we will be able to get some ideas of phasing of the project, how it can occur, and then time various other improvements that will go with that as the project develops. Once this community plan would be approved and the zoning that goes with it, the developer will have the set of standards that would apply to a particular piece of property. If we come in and change other aspects of the zoning code after that, it will not necessarily and probably wouldn't affect the standards that have been developed for the PC district, because basically that we'll adopt a plan, we'll adopt the zone that goes with that plan, to implement that plan, it'll be kind of free from other zoning changes that we might make over the life of the project. We'll get a look at the whole project up front and what the objectives are for the whole project, and then later be refining that with more detail and pieces as we go and how those fit into the whole. And then we will not have to be trying to force development into our zoning codes that we currently have, and I'll show that a little bit more in a couple of coming slides. But basically, again, we create a plan, and that plan becomes the zone, and make it easier to do mixed-use type development. Today, under our code, with the tools we have available, if somebody desires to develop some type of master plan, we could think of maybe Superstition Springs area or the Dobson Ranch area as examples from the past of desires to create a more mixed type of development with a variety of uses and present a master plan. We take that idea that the developer has for these uses. We take it through some filters, the general plan, to see what it would allow in an area, our existing zoning ordinance requirements with the various zones that are allowed, and then go through a public review process and end up with a final development. Today, that development has to fit into the various zoning categories that we have and the various standards of use within those zoning categories. So while we can kind of approximate that master plan idea that somebody had, what you see in the far right of the slide, we end up with boxes of different types of zoning that, again, kind of come together in terms of the master plan, but it's fitting into those separate categories. We have the PADs and the BIZs and the CUPs that kind of help us get a little bit creative with those, but they're still fitting into those boxes that are next to each other, not really maybe the unified whole that we had the idea of to start with. With the community planned community district that we're talking about, I think we can do a better job of accommodating a mixed-use master plan that we have envisioned in the community. Somebody, again, has the idea for mixed-use master plan development community. We would still take that idea through the same filters of review with the general plan, the zoning ordinance, and public comment. But because the plan becomes a zone, and because the community plan that gets adopted with that, we can allow for more flexibility in how the uses can fit together. They don't have to fit into the arbitrary standards of the individual zoning districts, but can truly become more mixed-use and more flexible. In the previous example, in the existing situations that we have in the Superstition Springs or Dobson Ranch areas, when somebody comes in and wants to move a land use from one place to another, they may have to do a general plan change, may have to do a zoning change to accomplish that. With the planned community approach, with the general plan designation and the overall development master plan and the flexibility of zoning, it'd be a lot easier to mix uses and move them around within the context of the overall plan as market conditions change. So it'll provide a lot more flexibility within the overall setting. In terms of the process, we have been working on a draft ordinance for some time, and we're trying to finalize that draft ordinance. Today we're here to present some of that information to you and get any feedback you have to see if there are any key points that we need to consider from your perspective in finalizing that ordinance, so that as we go through the P&Z process and bring it back to you, we'll have an ordinance that you'll be comfortable with. So based on the information we get from you today, we'll finalize this draft ordinance. We're on schedule to take it to the Planning and Zoning Board on their September 20th meeting. We'll follow up from there if necessary until they make their decision and recommendation. We'll bring it back to council. In order to help facilitate development in the community, we're hoping to get this adopted here fairly soon in the next month or two. So going on to some of the, again, the basic theory and reviewing that for the zone. Again, we start off at the time of zoning with the creation of what we call a community plan. That community plan applies to the overall site that's being developed and provides a high level of view. At that time, we get master utility and infrastructure plans that show us where the major streets are going to be, the major utility systems are going to be. We get some discussion about some of the community facilities that will be needed throughout the development in terms of parks and schools and those types of uses. We get some aggregate numbers on the type of development, the amount of residential use that's anticipated throughout the overall site, some land use amounts and intensities of land use for the non-residential developments in terms of gross square footage and the total property and the floor area ratios. And then we also, through the development units, get some generalized locations for those types of uses without being too specific at that point on where they will be. After the community plan is approved, then the next stage is development units that comprise portions of the overall project. Those come back for review and add a little bit more detail about where the different land uses will be and refinement to some of the development standards and guidelines. Then the final step in the process is a site plan that gets very specific about development type of site plans you see today. So next couple of slides are going to show a little more graphically that same concept. Starting with this slide and the picture on the left, that represents the total area that somebody is requesting the PC district for and the community plan would be applied to. At that level of review, we are seeing, again, gross information on terms of maximum number of residential units, maximum square footage for the non-residential uses. We're seeing the major street system, the major utility plans, and we're seeing a number of development units that would make up the total development proposal. And also at that time, we're seeing a general indication of how those overall uses will be split into the different development units. So for this example, we've pulled out development unit 4C and proposed that it's going to have the 150,000 to 200,000 square feet of industrial and 500 to 1 million square feet of commercial and no residential. So again, that gives us some idea of how that particular development unit would be developed in the future. Then we go to the next stage of developer actually ready to develop that particular development unit 4C, and they come in with the next level of refinement. And they start to show us there on the left how that overall development unit is going to be developed and how those land uses are going to be divided up throughout that development unit, and a little bit more refinement on the street system, utility plans, and those types of things. And then finally they come in with a site plan on an individual piece of property. So that's a quick overview again of what we're talking about in terms of this PC district and how it would work. In just a second, I'm going to turn this over to Gordon, and he's going to step through some of the key elements of the existing ordinance, or the draft ordinance at this point. Are there any questions you have about the basic concept and how it will work before we go into those?
On the major arterials, is there an entry point and an exit point so that there's some continuity in the arterials going through the project? Or do you not worry about that in the conceptual framework? That leads to a second question. There were some Prop 400 monies to build some road infrastructure. I don't think there was a whole lot because we thought that GM would still be around for a while through that area. So those two tie together as far as master arterial program continuity with our type of grid system to have good transportation movements and also potential regional funding.
Mayor, the negotiation process that would be used for a community plan would allow for us to negotiate with the applicant on where those arterial streets could go. Certainly, we would be looking at it from our perspective of maintaining that through traffic and that overall street grid system, and would want to see whatever is proposed implement that overall pattern of development.
Sometimes you have a conflict, though, because you're trying to move traffic on a grid system, and you're also trying to slow down traffic for residential development. You know, some of the Dobson Ranch thing comes to mind. It doesn't flow traffic through maybe as well on Dobson Road through the middle. It slows it down. So you've got a trade-off. Is it a regional transportation network road, or is it a commercial or a residential development? And sometimes those are in conflict. I'm just curious on how master plan addresses that.
Yes, Mayor, those would be part of the negotiations that would go into a particular plan and weighing out those different factors and ensuring that, we get the best plan to move the traffic while respecting the development around it.
At what level does the grid system come into play?
The community plan covers the arterial street system. Anything four lanes or larger is part of that community plan.
All right, but I see community plan level one up above that doesn't seem to have any grid, but once we get into the subsections of it, then it lays it out. So the subsections come in as part of the community plan with the road infrastructure or some of the major road infrastructure or at just entry and exit points on it?
Mayor, at the time of the community plan, one of the requirements that we're proposing is that they would have to show us the location for any street of four lanes or larger. They would go ahead and show that at that time. So we would see the layout, at least initial draft stage, of where those arterials are going to be at the time of the community plan.
All right. And okay, I'll just hold off then until we get to it. Let's go ahead and get into it in more detail, and maybe some of those questions will be answered.
Mayor, part of this in terms of drafting the actual ordinance is to determine philosophically what kind of ordinance you're drafting. Are you drafting one where you're requiring certain things in each step of the method through the process of the developer? Are you drafting one that gives the developer the opportunity to propose things and then kind of review those for appropriateness, which would be more of a general type of drafting methodology? And then there's a hybrid method where you might be able to say, well, we'll let them propose certain things, but other things we'll standardize so that there's a continuity or there's a standard way to approach these things for each different types of PC district that goes through. We tend to talk a lot about the Mesa Proving Grounds project, which will likely be one of the first PC districts that we see. But because of certainly the way we draft this, and certainly the opportunities for this type of district will come up in other places in the community as well, we have to think of how we're going to review those also. And so it's not just a one zoning district for one site. It's going to be multiple sites that we're going to be drafting this with. What we're proposing is that the minimum size for to be eligible to apply for a PC district is 160 acres. It's a quarter section of land. It's relatively large. We feel it's large enough that you might be able to organize a community around that size, as opposed to, say, a 10-acre parcel or a 15-acre parcel. The processing would be fairly similar to what you would see for a typical zoning case. It would go through the Planning and Zoning Board and the City Council. You would approve both the PC district as well as a community plan that would be associated with it. And the community plan would be the governing document that would say, this is how we're going to develop. These are the land uses and a few other things. Currently, we're proposing that the Planning and Zoning Board would review and approve the development unit plans or the secondary level. Once the council approves the community plan, that pretty sets in place all of everything, how everything else gets taken care of after that. And so by bringing it to Planning and Zoning, we can still have a public review process, have public input if necessary, but at the same time, try to keep the timing of it down to such a point where we don't necessarily have to go through, say, a four-month process like we would for a typical zoning case. We would be able to cut that down a little bit to a little bit less. And then we would go through the design review board or the planning director to approve site plans depending upon the status of that particular project.
Tom?
I'm concerned about that language. It suggests that the design review board is going to have approval over site plans, and that's not what we anticipate. I think they approve design, not site plans. So, you know, the things that are appropriate for design review board goes to design review board, but not things that aren't appropriate for the design review board. And I don't want an expansion of the authority and jurisdiction of the design review board.
So, if Mayor, if I'm, and Mr. Rawls, if I'm understanding you correctly, you would prefer to see that go to the Planning and Zoning Board?
I can go to the Planning Director at that point. We're talking about the third level
the staff.
Here. Right.
So, can go to all, so, in your mind, all site plans would go strictly to staff?
It could go staff, or if you want to take it back to Planning and Zoning, fine. But the jurisdiction of the Design Review Board does not now, and never has, and I hope never will, include site plan review. Site plan approval, and this language suggests that it would, and that is not desirable from my standpoint. Where else you take it that has appropriate authority, whether it's the zoning director, the planning and zoning board, or back to this council, I don't care. I just don't want to see the jurisdiction of the design review board expanded.
What was the thinking about the design review board? I read that the design review board would look at some of the design aspects of the development, the typical things they do in the relief and the setbacks and the rest, and then the planning director would look more at the site plan details on whether it makes engineering and all the rest. So are they, what was the intent? I'm trying to clarify, just like Tom is, I think.
Mayor, I guess the way we were looking at it is that typically the planning and zoning board, the councilor, are really looking at the uses, and somewhat the design, but primarily it's establishing the uses. The uses have gotten established already through the PC district and refined a little bit through the development unit, and we are looking at design issues then when we're strictly just looking at a site plan. And so the design review board is looking at design, and of the boards that can really look at a design and understand a design and a site plan, that probably made the most appropriate place to go in terms of a board, if a board is going to look at just a site plan with no real concerns about the land use because that's already been established. But as it's noted on here, first of all that can be stipped individually. And if this is one of the reasons we're here is to find out the comfort level with these things. And if the council would just like to see the design review board left out of it, we can go ahead and make that change.
Mayor, let's be careful. I think, say left out of it, what we're proposing here is a different concept that let's make sure we grasp this first. Is at the beginning of the process, much earlier on than you see today, the council will be presented with a variety of different conditions regarding design, regarding setbacks. You'll see that much earlier on in the process, almost at the first level, than you see today. Today, you don't see that level of detail. What the trade-off here is, by getting a commitment and the description of the details that we typically see later, get those established early on in the process. The trade-off is then to allow the developer in that second, third phase or afterwards that it becomes more flexible for them, allows them to move things around. But they've already established, if you would, kind of the framework, the standards that are on the front end. So one of the thoughts, I think where staff really needs to kind of hear from the council is, are you comfortable that once the council has approved those types of standards at the very beginning, and it'll be a much more involved process, at least at that first phase, than you have today, but once you've approved that, then once those guidelines, those standards are in place, then it should it be, in its most flexible term, be left to even just the staff, then to review and determine, yes, that meets those standards, and if it meets those standards, then we just move on forward and approve it. And then maybe it's when there's a request for an exception or something where we disagree or something like that, they'll be allowed maybe to appeal to, like, the Planning Commission, I guess, John. This is a different model. And so I think even the staff is trying to be sensitive to it's almost like, how do you take a new concept and we're very much involved in processing things. And so part of this is kind of a philosophical change
And some would suggest that if we're going to spend a lot of time on the front end establishing these details, and maybe we need to talk a little more what those details would be on the front end, if the council gets comfortable with that, and it's gone through P&Z and it's gone to council, once that's been in place, and maybe even Councilman Rawls at the front end, because of the design component, is it, you know, on the design side, maybe there's a DRB kind of weighing in, but once that happens on the front end, then on the further down the way, then those decisions can be, it's more of a, does it meet the standard, is it complying with the standard, can that be delegated to the staff? And I think that one of the things we want to get the council comfortable to get that direction, because that's different, is that you'd be okay with that.
I'm not sure whether the design review board or the design is going to be to that level of detail. You seem to assume that it'll be up front.
Well, some of the documents I've seen, and I, you know, maybe it doesn't go quite to the nth detail that our DRB has gone to today, but it is quite a bit of detail. Maybe Gordon or John may want to kind of give a description of what we anticipate on that community.
What we anticipate, Mayor and Council, is currently in Chapter 14 and 15 of the Zoning Ordinance, we have design guidelines and development standards, and those are relatively broad, and they encompass quite a bit of different types of development. What we anticipate seeing, it would be something even more further refined than you would see in our current zoning ordinance under the design guidelines or under the development standards. We believe we would see thematic elements. We believe we would see broad concepts in terms of design ideas. We believe that we would see things that might talk about anticipated goals of what the design's trying to achieve. We believe that we would see, you know, examples of materials, you know, not necessarily that would every building would be built the same way, but ideas that the developer would bring forward to say that this is what we anticipate this area looking like, this is what we anticipate another area looking like. And so they would basically kind of divulge what those themes would be, and then you would have a chance to review that. Kind of to go back to the mayor's and Mr. Rawls' question, currently the design review board is specified that they have to look at certain projects under the city under chapter 18 in the code. Design review board has to look at, for example, every commercial building that's fronting on a commercial street. And to a certain extent, there's a duplication of effort that takes place between the design review board and the P&Z as a zoning case goes through. One of the things that we've heard through the zoning code update process is that people sometimes disagree with that. They feel that duplication of effort is somewhat time-consuming. They don't like the idea of going to two board meetings, those types of things. And so the thought was is that, as Mr. Brady was talking about, the idea that rather than duplicating those efforts, and if the P&Z board has already signed off on certain aspects of this, and the council has already signed off on certain aspects of this, then we really are just into an aesthetic review. Maybe the organization of the buildings may be not necessarily quite to the level of detail you might see with the site plan that goes through P&Z, but certainly the rest of it is. And so the thought would be that by taking it to the design review board, you avoid that duplication of effort. That was the only reason we're trying to do. We're trying to make it easier for the developer rather than going through a two-step process. They're going through a one-step process instead, and they're just getting the aesthetic review right up front. In addition to that, we'll talk about this a little bit later on. We're talking about raising some of the levels, so they wouldn't necessarily see every single case in terms of the design review board. They wouldn't see the same number of cases that they might see now. They might see fewer cases, and only those cases are really going to have a major impact on the overall development itself. Most of the site plan review and most of the aesthetic review would actually be done by staff under what we're proposing right now anyway.
And let me take a step back. When you guys talked to us about this and you said how much control do you want the council to have after approval of the community plan, my answer was minimal.
Right,
so I endorse the concept here of having the community plan with the whole nine yards of approval, and if that includes design review at that point for those projects that are required to be submitted to design review, I'm happy with that. But as you get down lower and then have your development unit plan that's going to go just to P&Z, I'm okay with that. But the way number three reads here is that site plan review means something specific under our code. And site plan review is not now something that is within the purview and jurisdiction of design review. And I don't want design review to have that jurisdiction or purview.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. Now, if an aesthetic issue comes up, if a design review issue comes up at stage three, then it should go to design review. Maybe the problem is solved by replacing the word or with the word and, comma, as appropriate, comma, you know, so that you've got the things that belong to DRB going to DRB, and you have the things that don't belong there not going there.
Okay.
That's all I'm trying to say. I approve of the narrowing of our function. I approve of approving the big concept and then letting it fall within there. I appreciate the flexibility. I'm just not interested in having design review board do more than they do now. And I think I heard some murmurs of consent and agreement to that effect over here on my right. And the fact that anybody's to my right is an odd situation.
With your permission, when we get all through with the presentation, and if I noticed Mr. Critic Gamage is in the auditorium, if he'd be willing to give any insight he has. He does these kind of dealings in other communities. He's done them in other, I think, even states. So I'd like to hear what he has to say and any, if that would be permissible with the mayor to get through. And if Mr. Gamage would be willing to speak. So I've never known you not to be willing to speak, but that's fine.
Why don't we go ahead and go through the presentation here, and then I think that might be appropriate to make sure that one of the people representing a large portion of Mesa that's looking for something that gives more flexibility so they can do a quality project to see if we're on the same page or what the other part of the story might be.
Thank you, Mayor.
All right.
Going through some of the initial application requirements, we would ask for a pre-submittal conference. Basically, we'd use to determine what other kinds of plans might be necessary in order to organize this particular community plan. We can also begin discussion on what other required elements might be necessary. So, normal stuff, the application form, legal description, the ownership information, a statement of compliance with the Mesa General Plan, and then the community plan itself. The submittal requirements for community plan, we're proposing that there would be a map that would show the locations of the streets and the organization of the development units, that there would be what we call a land use summary and budget. And this is where they would lay out their land use descriptions, the intensity of the development, the permitted uses, and the amounts of each use they have. There would also show us the number and the size of each of the development units. So we can kind of get an organization. Again, they're beginning to organize how they intend to develop the property. There would be an estimated need for the community facilities, and this would give us a kind of a head start, so to speak, on figuring out what other infrastructure they might need other than just service to the site itself. We would have a master streets and utilities plans, again, just making sure the infrastructure is necessary to support the development. They would talk about what we refer to as general development standards, and these would be the typical development standards would be located in the zoning ordinance. So you would see things like parking requirements, setback requirements. We talk about maximum building heights, the landscaping requirements in terms of the amounts, landscaping areas, landscape islands and parking lots, those types of things. Also something that planners call build-to lines, which is the opposite of a setback. Rather than requiring the building to be set back a certain distance from the street, a build-to line says the building has to be built a certain distance from the street. And the idea is to create what's called a street wall, and it kind of organizes the street in a different way. You see it more in urban areas than you would see in suburban areas. We would talk about design guidelines, which are, again, broad and thematic. We're not talking about intimate details, but something to get an idea for how this project's going to be looking. We would ask for a development schedule, and particularly to get the anticipated phasing of the project through the development units, again, so that we can have our staff take a look at how the infrastructure is going to roll out across the project. Supplemental reports are basically just those things that we need in order to understand the project, as well as to talk about the requirements to the development unit plans and the site plans. To a certain extent, we would ask the developer to actually propose some processing requirements that would happen once the development unit is in place and once the site plan is in place, how we would actually process some of those plans. One of the key elements that we're talking about is the timing of when each of these projects would be reviewed. The PC district and the community plan would be approved concurrently or together because they're one and the same. There's some thought about, well, what if they were ready to go with one individual development unit? Should we review those concurrently, or should we wait until we have the community plan together so we have something to evaluate the development unit with, whether we can review those concurrently or not? Currently proposing that they can submit those together, but they might be considered individually in terms of cases. You couldn't consider the development unit until after the community plan had been adopted. The PC district, again, it's the actual adoption of the PC district is just like any other zoning district that you would have, whether it be C2 or PC or any. We're asking that an evaluation criteria be established. This is a little bit different, partly because it's such a different animal and such a different zoning district. We're asking to put that actually in the code. We're being upfront saying that if you plan to propose this type of PC district, this is the evaluation that you can expect. And we're trying to make things more predictable, both on the part of the applicant, on the part of the staff, as well as the part of any neighbors that might be looking at this and saying, what exactly is this particular animal? We're kind of trying to be, again, upfront about the conditions that can be attached to this. For example, if certain development units and the council's review of that, they show a particular interest in, and they want to make sure that those particular development units are done in a certain fashion rather than having P&Z be the level of review, the council could condition community plan so that particular development unit had to go clear up to council in terms of the review. They could modify the land use budget in summary if they weren't satisfied with that for some reason. They could modify some of the general development standards if they weren't satisfied with those. Or they could modify some of the off-site requirements. We're talking about a little bit different process for that as well. Development units, we're coming down a little bit. It's the second level review. We're beginning to fill in some of more of the details. But again, the idea is that the development unit would be consistent with all of the things that got approved up here at the community plan level. It's reviewed against that. That's the method for evaluating the development unit, is how consistent it is with the community plan. You're going to get additional information about that in terms of the amounts, the intensities of land uses, the approximate sites, and some of the details about some of the design requirements. They can come in and with some of the design ideas that they had up here, they provide further refinement, and that allows for the developer to refine those design ideas during the phasing of this project and allows him to adjust to market conditions. Again, estimates of the construction phasing, and the development units really become the basis for the infrastructure planning. They get a chance to figure out how much service is needed over here versus how much service is needed elsewhere on the overall plan. Kind of going real quickly back to that drawing that we showed you earlier, we kind of pull out the development unit, but one of the key aspects of this is to take a look at, okay, at the community plan level, you're getting some information, but not a whole lot. But then we start trying to convert that and trying to get some more details graphically. Where would the parcels be? Where would the actual physical areas would be? We're asking them at the community plan level just to tell us what kind of zoning they might use for certain areas. Well, in the development unit plan and later in the site plan, we'll get more details actually where those boundaries might be kept, or at least approximation of how much they're going to use for each one. And that allows us to sit here and to do enforcement later on once the actual site planning takes place. The third level review is the site plan. We had proposed design review board or planning director as default. An alternate might be proposed by the developer as part of the community plan. We've talked about that, so we've got our direction there. We're talking about appeals of site plan approval. That the appeal of the site plan would go, we initially proposed to DRB, but I think we're hearing that we probably should be taking that to the P&Z board instead. And then the P&Z board decision would be appealed to City Council. We're proposing that we would limit the ability of an aggrieved party to appeal, rather than being a citywide type of ability to appeal, that it would only be people within 1,000 feet of the individual property. A person in Dobson Ranch may not necessarily have a particular interest in what's going on at the Mesa Proving Grounds. It would not seem to me to fall a rational connection there. But we're thinking that if you're within a quarter mile of the site, it would make a connection. That's being part of the proposal. We're also saying that site plan approval would expire after 2 years. As things evolve, things may change. You can approve it once, or redo, or I should say extend the site plan approval once, but after that they would have to redo the site plan, because after 4 years, it's kind of hard to sit here and hold up other projects because you're waiting for another project to develop somewhere over here. We're also talking about a concept called the transfer of development potential, and this would be the unused development potential on a site. So if we went back to, for example, the community plan, there might be something in 4A that wasn't used, but they found out that they need more land use over in 5B. Rather than having to take this all the way back through, if it's a reasonable transfer, say under 10%, then they might be able to do that simply through an administrative process. It might be approved by the planning director. So that gives some flexibility there. Some fail-safes that we have in there. The transferred use must be already permitted in the receiving development unit, so they couldn't transfer a new land use into the development unit. We would ask them to make sure that both the owner and the sender, both the owner of the sending unit and the owner of the receiving unit, agree to the transfer. That the result of this ends up being with a development on the receiving end that's going to be compatible with and not detrimental to surrounding properties. We wouldn't want to create impacts on the receiving site that wouldn't work with the surrounding development units. As well as if the transfer ends up being a major, what we would refer to as a major amendment to the plan, that would come all the way back up to the city council. But the idea is that there's a certain cap on the community plan in terms of the overall development, but they're working within the cap, just kind of transferring that overall to where it might be work best within the overall plan itself. Major amendments, we're proposing that there would be these would be the minimums that we would consider to be in terms of what constitutes a major amendment. It would be a change to the overall boundaries of the district, increases to the overall total of the cap of development that was approved with the community plan. If there were significant changes to the boundaries of the individual development unit, that would come back to council for approval. If there's greater than a 10% change to the dwelling count or the gross floor area within an individual development unit, that would come back to council. If there's some kind of change that creates a negative impact on the infrastructure system, that would come back to council, or certain things that would be determined by the planning director. Everything else would be considered a minor amendment and addressed at a staff level. And again, unless there's a condition that's placed in there by the city council. And so that's what we're thinking are the key elements in terms of the details of how we're drafting this ordinance, and we're available for any questions you may have or any comments you may have.
Okay. One of the aspects of this that I've always wanted to protect is the arrival and departure routes out of Williams Gateway. So when we go through this and we get to the submittal of the community plan, I assume that then you could have non-residential areas, it can be commercial, industrial, whatever, but have a category of some kind, because we always had that mixed use employment that, you know, and I think some of us figured out you could have there was a category in there up to 20% residential in it. I don't think it was well known, but it became well known real quickly. And we had to change that in this area, I know, or throughout the zoning code. So part of the aspect is I like the idea of the landowner knows what is best for their parcel, but I also have, we have an airport there that we want to make sure, and I think the landowner probably would concur, but that needs to be viable long-term, and the residences that are going to be in there know what's an appropriate area for them, so they don't complain about commercial and industrial building next to them, and they kind of know what they're set up. So this, I believe, will accomplish that task also. The only thing I'm a little curious about is then how does it transition from one use to the other? And I assume that we'll look at the community plan and see what their transitions are, because there's also some industrial areas and other things that are very close to this property, if not right adjoining to it. So how does that kind of fit into this in the context of what I'm used to thinking about specific land use designations?
Mayor, as we've worked on this, we've talked about various ways to approach that particular concept, and right now what we're considering is a statement in there with regard to development units that says that they will need to be in a sufficient size and number to give us a clear understanding of how they will be implemented. And so when we're talking about sensitive areas, as you've just talked about, we won't want to see, again, for instance, the GM property, it come in as one development unit, because we're going to need to have a little bit more specificity. And where we do know there are those sensitive areas, we may want to see smaller development units so we can look more closely at those uses and make sure we are keeping the residential far enough away and we're getting the transitions appropriate from what we know we need to be in industrial area to those residential areas. So it'll come back to the negotiation process and getting development units, again, of that particular size and shape that will respect those boundaries that we need to see protected.
Okay. The under the utility infrastructure, streets, drainage, and you also indicated, I think, there were some three-year plans or some planning horizons that we expect. Why wouldn't the developer come through and say, this is going to go pretty quickly, and we are, for infrastructure, for water, sewer, we anticipate this certain demand within a certain period of time. Puts the pressure back on the cities to have to build off the wastewater treatment plants, the CAP, the second CAP plant. So we have a huge infrastructure upfront investment, and then this thing doesn't develop out till way in the future. We have a sunk upfront cost in advance of what we needed. So how do you coordinate a large section of land being developed and that coming online and still having the infrastructure in place to serve it, but not wasting a bunch of money by doing it far in advance of when the demand calls for it? How is all that going to be coordinated on something of this size?
Mayor, as Mr. Brady indicated earlier, this process, while similar to process in the past, is going to be a little bit more extended in terms of when initial application comes in and it'll actually get to council. There will be a lot of discussion and negotiation that will go on between the various city departments and the developer to try to refine those and understand the different impacts and where, you know, there are major city improvements that are needed. For part of the development, we'll have to work with them very closely on those timing issues, and they'll have to understand our responsibilities overall in the city and our timing constraints to make sure those can work as closely as possible.
Okay, and I guess I need some to see if there's any, you know, like a greenfield wastewater treatment plant. I believe that can be expanded out in some increments. I'm not familiar enough with what increments they are and what type of usage is going to be diverted there. Same thing with the water treatment. When does that next CAP plant need to come online and start treating some more CAP water? I know we have the site and the rest, but that's a huge cost. And I assume you want to do a large project because there's some economics of building it, but I don't know the usage and the pre-built, how well that works and our bonding. So there's some financial costs that I'm not comfortable with yet. So,
right. Mayor, I think that's a great question. I think that's why, in some ways, I really like this approach, because we're going to get a lot more information up front, hopefully earlier on in the process. So as we do our capital improvement planning, you know, part of it is just understanding the intensity of development, the uses of development, and what kind of demand that'll put on our infrastructure. And then we can begin to plug that into our CIP. Now, obviously, there's some projects, and you mentioned them, whether it's a treatment plant or whatever, that take a tremendous amount of lead time in order to be available, but right now we already have built-in significant capacity. So it's always kind of trying to stay ahead of and making sure you retain that additional capacity out there. And I think that's just something that comes with working with the developers as they begin bringing their plans in and we start anticipating that growth in a measured way. And you're right. I mean, we have to be careful we don't get too far ahead of it, because part of the assumption is that new growth coming in generates the cash that begins to pay back those capital improvements. But I think working with the developers, our city engineer, and our utilities department, I think we can come to a pretty good measured way of looking at those. I mean, it's not uncommon. A lot of cities do this all the time. But it does help, and I think this is why I like this idea, is we'll get more of that information actually on the front end, which gives us, in theory, more time to begin putting that infrastructure in place. Now, how we're going to pay for it all and maintain it, you know, that's a question that we know we have part of the strategic planning study that we have going right now is also kind of looking at, are there different models for how to help pay for, and really not just the capital cost, but the maintaining of it over time.
Okay, I think there has to go through a plan review if, in fact, they want to increase by more than 10% or something. There's another step. But there was no step that if it was going to decrease by more than 25% or something else, so that what's the bottom side? We've built all this infrastructure, and all of a sudden they decide not to go as grandiose as they want, and we've got some sunk cost out there that if we're going to go to build out, and we're building it to build out, then how do you get that back? Because the other side of that equation. I hope that doesn't happen, but
right,
I just...
Something you have to be careful with.
Yeah. All right, Tom.
That's interesting, although I'm not sure I know how you could force them to build to the size that they said they were going to build if the economy turns down or if they have trouble or whatever, but I appreciate the foresight, but man, that's a tough one. That's why you can't get specific performance of the sale of property. You can't force a landowner to sell your property. That's difficult.
Well, and Mayor and Councilman Rawls, what you can do, at least in anticipation, we can get the bonds authorized. Doesn't necessarily mean we sell the bonds, and we can, as long as we have, you know, funding available. But it's your point is, I think there has to be some triggers that you look from a developer and their commitments of infrastructure, and a lot of that comes, even for them, comes early on in the process because they have a lot of infrastructure work that they have to do to match up with the, you know, our regional. So I think it's a coordination process that we can do. Obviously, it takes a lot of dialogue and discussion with developers. So.
And it takes a long time to develop 2,600 acres or 3,000 acres or whatever it is. You can't do that overnight. So I, you know, to make sure that everyone understands, I really appreciate the job that you've done here. I think it's excellent. I think I approve of all the elements except for the one that I mentioned. You know, I certainly don't, Gordon, I don't want your wife saying I was mean to you again. So,
she never says that.
Yeah, I don't. But at any rate, I was close one time. But at any rate, on page 13, one of the key elements was about the considered together and separate. If they want to come forward with a development unit at the same time they come forward with a community plan. To me, that would be similar to a general plan amendment with the zoning case that runs along with it. We consider them separately on the agenda when we get to them, and obviously if the general plan isn't amended, then the zoning case goes away. Well, the same thing is true here. If the community plan isn't approved, then the development unit plan fails. But I think the idea of not, if they're ready to go on one unit, I don't want to make them go through the whole process of the community plan and then start over with the development unit plan and then move forward. I think contemporaneously is fine as long as they understand that the CP doesn't go through, the DUP is dead on arrival. So, and I also like, just by way of comment, the 1,000-foot limit on the appeal, because contrary to what you said, Gordon, people in Dobson Ranch do care about what happens out at Williams Airport and, you know, out in that area, but I don't think they should have a right to appeal. So I like all the elements. I like the way you structured it. I think it's a flexible, comprehensive way to develop large parcels of property, and I, until Grady tells me I'm wrong and I change my mind, I think it's a good way to go.
Okay.
So I approve it.
Rex.
Yeah, a lot of times I'm asked why don't we don't get great projects in Mesa, and I think part of the reason was we had very inflexible, antiquated zoning laws that made it very difficult to build a very creative project. I think this, and what I would encourage you is keep maximum flexibility in this to allow creative thinking and new thinking for Mesa. I'm afraid that, you know, just because how processes work, we might tend to strangle and restrict it too much at the very beginning. So that's my only admonition. I think this is a great way. We're moving towards a modern planning and zoning system. I'm excited about what I see, which is hard. Some people get excited about zoning, but I think this is a big step forward. So thank you.
Okay. Grady, you want to join us with any comments this morning?
Sure, Mayor.
Mayor, members of the council, my name is Grady Davis Jr., I'm representing DMV on the Mesa Proving Ground property, and that is the sort of presumptive poster child for using this. We're real excited. We've spent a lot of time working with the staff. We have had some differences, and we're working through those. Just a little bit of background, that PCDs are not new. Phoenix has been doing this for about 20 years. the Foothills, Mountain Park Ranch, our PCDs, all the Point Resorts. Desert Ridge is essentially a PCD. Vistancia and Peoria, Verado and Buckeye are other examples of PCDs. And the basic deal, as Mr. Brady, I think, explained particularly well, is you make the big picture policy decisions up front at a big scale, and then you push the details down largely to the staff. And we're in favor of most of those details going to the staff with the kind of appeal that's been outlined here. I have noticed in the time I've been working on this in Mesa, I've noticed at the Planning and Zoning Commission, I've noticed at the City Council, a penchant for leaping to details right away whenever anything is brought up. I don't know if this is something that is just endemic in Mesa. I mean, this happens other places, but it seems to be particularly the case in Mesa, as I've noticed. And a little of that has happened in this process. All we're talking about here is an enabling ordinance to make this possible. And in our view, that ordinance ought to be kept as simple and bare bones as possible. What you're doing is you're saying we're going to let the developer propose to us what the rules are for a big development. And so you're going to get a proposal that's going to be pretty thick and pretty detailed, and you're going to go through it, and if you like it, you approve it, and if you don't, you don't. And it's a very negotiated document with the staff. To the extent there isn't anything resolved with the staff, it gets highlighted for a decision by the policymakers. But that document is the place where the details get fleshed out, and many of the things you've been asking about this morning. All this is it just lets us propose that. So our advice has been to keep this as simple and as clean as possible. The biggest difference we've had with the staff, I think, is a concern on their part that they wanted to have default provisions. If somebody doesn't propose something in a PC document, well, then this is how it works. And that's okay. As long as we have the flexibility to propose an alternative, we're fine with having a default in there. We would even go so far as to allow most of the procedures, the line between a major and a minor amendment, which of the development units might come back to the council for review. We'd put all of that in the PC document. And so the hybrid, if you remember back to a bunch of slides ago, we've been urging the more general ordinance. The staff have been coming at it from the more prescriptive. The hybrid is an attempt to bridge that difference. We haven't seen the detail of that yet, but I think we'll probably be able to get pretty close together in doing that. So, we're very enthused. This is a mechanism we want to use. We've used it before. DC Ranch in Scottsdale, as well as Verado, are PCDs that DMB has done. We anticipate the Mesa Proving Ground being a different kind of PCD than those, however. Those of you who've been to our forums and everything know we're thinking about bigger stuff. Bigger buildings, more employment, bigger uses, kinds of things. So this will be a pretty unique PCD in terms of the mix of uses it's going to have.
Okay. Kyle first. Kyle?
I find your comment interesting, Grady, about jumping to the details, because from what Tom said and the general feeling of some of us up here is we don't want to get drug out in design review and stuff. We want it to be, look, you're a developer, you're developing, you got the whole big picture, what you're going to do. You're going to probably stay pretty consistent with your theme of design and making your whole project successful as a whole. And that's what we want to see, but we want to make sure that we do have the protection that somewhere along the road you don't just sell off one piece and say,
right,
well, okay, and then we're stuck with having to make sure they fit in. So the default, as long as you have an alternative to come back, I think it's great. But overall, I'm excited to see this come forth.
Rex?
Question for Mr. Grady, if I could. As I understand, the other cities sort of have an enabling legislation, and then the details are worked out in another document or a procedure manual. Is that the approach that they take?
Yes, Mayor Councilmember Griswold, what you're calling in this draft the community plan is not just a map with a plan on it. It's also the rules. It's the zoning ordinance that governs the community, and so that's where the details are worked out. We've said in other contexts, you ought to be able to do the enabling ordinance 5 or 6 pages. Well, you guys want more pages? That's okay. We don't care.
But the enabling ordinance says, here's how you propose the planned community. Now when we propose the planned community, then that's what spells out both the development standards, the design standards, and the procedures that govern the community. There is, from in defense of the staff's position, I think there is some desirability, particularly if you thought you were going to get a lot of these, to have some consistency in procedure from one to another. I don't know that you are going to get a lot of them, but that has been, in some jurisdictions, that has been a problem where every single one is governed by a different procedural system. And that, I have seen jurisdictions that have had to fix that over time. So I understand why they're concerned about that.
Well, I believe over 70% of our land is built out, so the chances of getting a large number of these, particularly with the number of property owners we have, I would say would be slight.
I think that's probably right. I've heard two or three other properties besides the Proving Ground that people think might be suitable to it.
So you would recommend an enabling with a procedure, or the developer who does this for a living, does a good reputation of doing large ones, he proposes sort of the language in this document that gets shredded by our group?
I haven't seen the staff's latest draft. We may be very close at this point. I think that our original proposal wouldn't have put default standards in the ordinance. It would have just said, here's the procedure you follow to propose a PCD. Still takes 6 or 7 pages to say that, but that's kind of the deal. The staff have wanted to say, here's the procedure you follow, but if you don't specify certain things, here's how it will work. That's okay with us, because we'll specify in the PCD we're doing. And so building defaults in, if that gives the staff comfort, I think that's fine. I don't think we will have a big problem with that. We would be a little bit more flexible in the enabling ordinance, probably, in defining the amendment aspects and the procedural aspects. But as I say, I haven't seen the latest draft. I think we're real close, so I think we will get there.
I'm just not used to an attorney asking for less pages. This is a new thing for me, so thank you.
Mike.
Greedy, one of the things that I'm concerned about out there, and I think maybe you guys are too, and that's why I'm glad there's some flexibility in this, is the departure pattern. The mayor talked about protecting the airport. You know, for a long time I've been under the feeling that the departure pattern is holding back the airport. The fact that you've got to make the hard right turn, which interrupts your property as well as causes problems for pilots. I hope that the political process will work over your development to where there can be a compromise somewhat. And with your entire area plan, if you're going to submit, it needs to have the flexibility to change rapidly if, in fact, the FAA and Phoenix and everybody gets together and gets us a pattern, I think, that's workable. The fact that you've got a whole bunch of really valuable land with the departure pattern, you can't be used for the most productive use, in my opinion, of that land. And I think that's something that we need to work on as a region to make sure that the airspace is protected so that it doesn't kill that development. You look at Scottsdale Air Park and the amount of jets that are in and out of there, I'm sure they have a lot of noise complaints. But they have multi-million-dollar homes under the path, too. So there has to be some sort of a plan that will enable those things to work together.
Mayor, Councilmember Whalen, yeah, interestingly, many of those jets come right in over DC Ranch and Silverleaf, which DMV developed, has the highest median price point of any development in Arizona. I think we've all recognized, back to when the general plan process was going through and when I was coming in front of you for General Motors, we've all recognized that at the point at which a plan is proposed for the Proving Ground is when we really need to sit down and figure out, okay, what is the issue here? What should the rules be? How do we spell that out? And that's what we anticipate doing as we come forward with the community plan for the Proving Ground. In the meantime, we've all been kind of in a holding pattern, I guess, of sort of waiting for, okay, what is it we really want to do, and what is it we really need to do to protect the airport? And that's right where we're beginning our planning process and thinking about it now. We're not prepared yet to show you what that is, but that's exactly what the community plan will do, I think.
I would hope that we could all work together to exert the political influence on the FAA and with Phoenix and everyone else to make sure that this plan protects the airspace in the future, protects the airport, and yet allows for appropriate development.
Okay, Tom?
A couple of points. I know we're probably not going to have a lot of these, but I tend to favor the hybrid model here where there is a certain procedure set, and then the developer comes in with the land uses, the descriptions, the standards. But it seems to me that if every individual developer can come in with his own set of rules as to how the game is going to be played, we're going to be approving those rules at the same time we approve the plan, because it's part of the plan. I'd rather have the rules set ahead of time, and I think that's sort of the direction our staff has done. Brady, I appreciate what you're saying, and I think there are ways of blending those two so that it's not onerous. On the amendment process, you know, I think I don't mind having the staff identify things that are going to be considered a major plan amendment, but maybe a language that says, you know, unless the community plan, I started to say comprehensive plan, it's the wrong word. That's why you have to have more than five or six pages, because you have to define your words, and that takes at least five. Yeah. So, you know, maybe the community plan, the ordinance could provide for a different definition of what's a major amendment under that particular plan. And if the staff signs off on it and then brings it forward as part of the plan, then you have what you want. So, you know, there's ways of solving that. But again, I go back. It's terrific progress.
Okay. Any other comments on this item?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you need any specific direction, or is the conversation here this morning sufficient to take it forward?
We've got it.
All right. Item number four is hear reports on meetings and our conferences attending. Scott?
Two meetings. My calendar was quite full yesterday, and I was conflicted out, so I attended the Mesa Convention and Visitors Bureau Board. We discussed the relocation of the ball fields a little bit, and they're very excited about the positive direction that is taking. We also had the presentation that we heard today on Williams Gateway Airport, which after two meetings, I think I can pretty much give that presentation verbatim if they need somebody else to give it. They seem to be very, very much in support of the Phoenix Mesa being renamed. It feels a business decision. Some people would rather it be Mesa Phoenix, but they will bow to the Phoenix Mesa because they understand the need to put it to a region and understand that. Also attended a Homeland Security Coordinating Committee meeting for the state. The state has received a substantial sum of money, around $90 million in grants, from federal grants for UASI to help the urban areas improve their security, policing, fire protection for online security incidents.
All right. Anyone else? All right. Number five is scheduling of meetings and general information.
Yes, Mayor. Just to remind Council, our next study session will be September 13th. And that study session will be followed by an Audit and Finance Committee meeting. And then we'll have our Monday, September 17th council meeting. Thank you very much.
Okay. Right. Are there any requests to speak this morning?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay. Then I entertain a motion to adjourn. All in favor say aye. We adjourn.